Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back, and we are continuing going through our top 100 movies of all time. Up to number 29, I'm talking The Secret in Their Eyes. We're talking about The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which is replacing Moonrise Kingdom for John, because I have Moonrise Kingdom all the way up in my top 10, so we won't be getting to that one just quite yet. But The Secret in Their Eyes, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, two, I would say, relatively unseen movies. The Secret in Their Eyes, one of the best foreign language film back in 2009, had a Hollywood remake that was terrible. Shocker, who would have thought? Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus is pretty much famous because it was the final movie Heath Ledger was filming at the time of his death, and all of the crazy stuff that Terry Gilliam had to try to do to make that make sense. That doesn't necessarily mean people went and saw it, because they really didn't, and it wasn't that well reviewed. Although this was the first time I watched it, and I quite enjoyed it. And John has it on here as his replacement for Moonrise Kingdom, so that's good. But John, how was your week?
It was pretty good. I mean, I had a 2-day work week this week, so you would think it meant I watched a lot of movies. It didn't. I only watched one movie outside of our two movies this week, but
man, you that's are good because
I got to watch these two great movies.
You're slacking, man. That's all I'm going to say.
I know.
I'm just like, I just can't believe it. I just can't believe it. But, all right, well, let's talk about Imaginary of Dr. Parnassus first. It's not in the top 100, but it's a pretty reasonable replacement, I think, for Moonrise Kingdom. It's hard to find like a Moonrise Kingdom type movie, because that is such a unique movie to Wes Anderson and like coming of age and whatever. But Terry Gilliam's a weird guy, over stylized, similarly to what Wes Anderson does. Why'd you pick this one?
I mean, you've pretty much summed up exactly why. It's kind of that idea of, like, the over-stylized approach that Gilliam takes is kind of similar to Anderson. And to be honest, this was a movie that I definitely considered, like, breaking into my top 100. Upon rewatching it, I don't think it's going to moving forward. I've just watched far too many good movies that have pushed it further away from my top 100 now. But I've always found this one really enjoyable. And I found that, like, Gilliam's approach to this modern fairy tale and this, like, Faustian devil relationship in this film is just so interesting. And this is a film, not like you said, not many people have seen. It did get a bunch of press because Heath Ledger did die during the filming of it. I remember that was part of the reason why I originally went and saw it when it released in 2009. But I just really enjoy this film. I enjoy the whimsy behind it. I enjoy the ideas behind it. And I really enjoy how Gilliam, who kind of got more serious as time went on, kind of went back to his more less serious topics that he's approaching with this one. And like I said, it's just this fairy tale that's so easy to engage with.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the style of this. I haven't seen too many Terry Gilliam movies. I've only seen like a handful. I know he's got quite a cult following. I just, you know, he's one of those directors that he's an interesting director because a lot of people know who he is, but I don't think a lot of people necessarily know what he's done. And I don't even think necessarily that people really like everything he's done. You know, he's done Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which is obviously iconic. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I don't like that movie. Like 12 Monkeys, Brazil. You know, he's got some good movies for sure and movies that people have heard of, but he is so stylized. I really enjoyed the style of this movie. And I thought it was really interesting what he did with Heath Ledger passing and bringing in Colin Farrell and Johnny Depp and Jude Law and having them play that character as like the other people's fantasy of what he would look like. I thought that was a really good idea. My biggest problem with the movie was the story at the beginning makes like, It's like he didn't even want to set up a story at the beginning. Like, I understand that there's a story there, but it's like, okay, you know, she only has this, like Andrew Garfield or Vern Troyer. One of them seems in on it with Christopher Plummer involving the devil and all that. And then like halfway through the movie, it's like, well, five souls for five souls or something like that. And I'm like, well, wait, what was the thing at the beginning? And then it kind of gets explained, but not really. And I just feel like there was such an easy, I think it got a little like substance over style over substance in the beginning part of this movie, when there's so much style in the second half that they could have just had the first half have a lot more substance to get us into this world. I'm fine with that opening to let us know it's modern day, but there's this weird old thing that's traveling. Like, I'm fine with all that stuff. I just thought it was interesting that this story feels like it just takes a little bit to get really rolling here for some reason, even though it seems like it's a very easy one to define.
Yeah, I almost forgot how slow this movie is to get started, where it kind of introduces you to the fact that there's this traveling troupe and they're out there doing this thing with this imaginarium that's not really defined, and you know something up with it because of the opening scene where the one guy goes in, everything's all a little wonky and everything. You're trying to figure out, piece it together, and you get these stories kind of explaining the background of everything, and it's hinted at that there's like this nefarious deal going on that'll revolve around Parnassus's daughter and her 16th birthday and what's going to happen with it. But it is a little confusing at first. Heath Ledger's character isn't even introduced until like half an hour into the movie or something like that. And I kind of forgot how much he is not really the main focus of this movie.
Yeah.
Where usually someone like Heath Ledger would be a protagonist, and whether it was originally intended for him to be a protagonist, and Gilliam kind of warped the story around the fact that he couldn't use him as a protagonist, or if in the end there is no straight protagonist in this film, because it's more focusing on this battle between good and evil and morals and everything like that. The movie takes a bit to get into, but I think once you're invested in it, it just becomes so enjoyable because of the way that Gilliam is presenting these philosophical ideas of inner enlightenment versus instant gratification and things like that.
It almost feels to me like it's like a Gandalf and Saruman thing, where like they're kind of the ones who know everything, but Frodo and Sam and everybody else who's going on in there is like really where your bread is buttered. And it's like Christopher Plummer and Tom Waits know everything, and they kind of like, Christopher Plummer kind of feels like the protagonist, Tom Waits kind of feels like the antagonist, and they're kind of, you know, butting heads in whatever way. However, they're not the main protagonists and antagonists of the movie. But again, like, I'm fine with Heath Ledger even coming in later. I just wish that it would have been established like right off the bat exactly what the stakes are for Amanda Seyfried lookalike and for Christopher Plummer and Andrew Garfield, but it's not. And it's just like, why are they all so invested in helping Dr. Parnassus with this if they don't really understand the stakes? That's where I was like, what is going on? But then once the movie gets rolling and they do find Heath Ledger and that just gets going, I'm like, whatever, this is great. I'm all in. I'm watching this. Tom Waits is great. I mean, Tom Waits is the best part of this movie.
By far.
He's so good in this movie. But I just wish there was a little bit more. I just wish the opening made a little bit more sense to me.
Yeah, it's really weird because you don't often find a movie that you sit down and watch and say, this could really use a prologue. Mm-hmm. And like, that's exactly what this is missing. To continue with like the Lord of the Rings comparison, the Fellowship of the Ring starts with the battle for Middle Earth, right? And that sets up the story. You know everything that's going on because of that. And that's drastically what this film's missing to kind of set things straight. Because even when we do get into it, and the storytelling that Gilliam does decide to do, where we kind of like flash back to explain exactly what this conflict is, it almost feels like it comes too late, because you want to be invested in that right at the beginning of the film.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And that's what I guess threw me off about this. I mean, it's a weird movie. You got to know it's going to be weird. Terry Gilliam, like, you have to know that's coming. But the weirdness didn't bother me. It was just the straightforwardness. Like, in this, like, I think about like a movie like Brazil. It's a pretty straightforward, weird movie, but it's, you know, it gets its point across. It tells its story. It's done. It's whatever. Gilliam does have a way of going style over substance a lot. I mean, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I think, is the most extreme example of that ever. It is so much style over substance. But I just think, like, with this movie, it literally took like two or three more scenes, and for me, this would have been like a phenomenal movie. Like I still enjoyed this movie, but I think it needed two or three more scenes, and all of a sudden, it's at a different level. But that all being said, I think the best thing to take away from a movie like this is what Terry Gilliam and what this cast and crew were able to accomplish, despite the fact that Heath Ledger died during the making of this. I almost compare it to All the Money in the World, which Kevin Spacey didn't die, but Kevin Spacey gets pulled from the movie because of all the allegations against him. They bring in Christopher Plummer, and Christopher Plummer plays the role. Another movie, nobody really saw it, didn't really get great reviews, but it had a lot of conversation around it. And it just kind of shows that, like, how do you get creative when you need to? Because if you remember the All the Money in the World trailer when this came out back in 2016, 2017, whatever it was, that trailer was all set up with blah, 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 and then here's Kevin Spacey. And it was like every day, and then here's the reveal of Kevin. Like, Kevin Spacey in that role was the selling point of the movie. Like, that was Oscar hype right off the bat, everything. And then all the allegations came out. Now you have to change the whole thing. Another one, something like Wind River, coming out right at the time of the Weinstein debacle. And so they pull the funding from the Weinstein company. They didn't want the Weinstein company to put their movie out anymore. Doesn't really get seen. That one actually did get great reviews, but you have to get creative with how you're going to market it now and how you're going to do this. I think The Imaginary of Dr. Parnassus, in the hands of anybody except for Terry Gilliam, would have never succeeded, because they would have said, well, shit, we don't have Heath Ledger. We can't do half these scenes. And Gilliam was able to get so creative. And I think it's just this is such a testament just to, like, filmmaking in general and, like, what can go into this process. It's very, very, very impressive. And to see Terry Gilliam be able to pull this movie off despite everything is just incredibly impressive.
Yeah, especially when you consider watching the film, you can definitely tell the point where they just didn't have anything more from Heath Ledger. Because we get to that, I think it's just over the halfway point where we spend pretty much the entire rest of the movie in the Imaginarium. And it's great that Gilliam at least had all of these, like, non-Imaginarium scenes with Heath Ledger already that he could use. The fact that the changing of Heath Ledger into Johnny Depp and Jude
Keep
Law
going. I'll be right back.
And Colin Farrell. It's just, it's so perfectly set up by this little instance in the very first time we get into the Imaginarium when the drunkard falls in the puddle and he realizes his face is different. It's so easy. It seems so easy what Gilliam's able to pull off here to adjust this story, but you can't help but think there is so much more to this story that Gilliam was going to put forward originally with the plans of just having Heath Ledger instead. And his pivoting to include these other characters. Luckily, he has this dream world where it's possible to do so. And this story is just perfectly suited for this tragedy that plagued the production.
Well, yeah, and in that early scene where they do show the guy the first time he goes into the Imaginarium and his face changes. Like, it's so simple to fix that. And now all of a sudden it can be anybody. And then we have the scenes of home economics or whatever the hell it is. And it's Colin Farrell constantly sitting there. And that's, like, her, like, fantasy. She just can't get enough of Colin Farrell. Like, it's all very uniquely done. But I agree when you originally said, and I know I missed half of that, I locked my wife out of the house. But when you had originally said that they were, you can tell when they ran out of material for Heath Ledger. I think there's a scene in this movie where they're all sitting around talking about him. And it was so clear to me that he was supposed to be involved in that scene, but they had never filmed him. It's like when they're in, like, the train car or something. So they have to have the conversation about him and what he would be saying or doing in that moment. Very interesting scene for sure. And it is very clear that, like, yeah, there was a big chunk of Heath Ledger that was not filmed by the time of his death.
Yeah, but I mean, even in that scene where you just have Heath Ledger, like, banging on the door from the outside, like, it still works. And that's what's so impressive about this, is Gilliam's ability to edit this. Because I don't even think the delays on this movie were that long. I think it was a couple of months tops for rewrites, and then they got back to filming it, which is even wilder when you consider the fact that most of this movie is filmed in England, in London, until you get to the very end, and I very clearly say oh, that's the Vancouver Library.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, this movie was filmed in England. Why is Vancouver here all of a sudden? And you can kind of tell that this production, as someone who obviously has seen the Vancouver Library extensively throughout his life, it was noticeable. But even seeing that, it's not even a consideration of, oh, yeah, right, this must have been filmed after Heath Ledger's death.
Yeah. Yeah. And why do you think they made like that change? Like, what's the point of that? Or was that already like
location changed?
Yeah.
I think it was more to symbolize the fact that Parnassus is just like kind of wandering the earth again after the whole ordeal and after the bet with Mr. Nick. And he's just wandering, trying to find Valentina again. And I think it just happens to be, I mean, the Vancouver Library is this very iconic looking building. So I think it's just like a cool place to have this scene shot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's the visuals. There's some visuals in this movie, whether they're real, fake, whatever, that are just absolutely stunning. And they are just like so impressive. It's funny how much of a hard time Terry Gilliam has getting movies made because of how successful he was early on and because of like what a vision he does have. And it's so I'm just so curious, like, why did that not translate better for audiences? You know what I mean? Like, why did that just not hit them better?
It's a really good question, because you have to take into consideration how successful would this movie have been if Heath Ledger had finished it, or if Heath Ledger never died, right? And this is just another thing in Heath Ledger's catalog. But it probably still gets the same reception, right? It's probably very rarely seen. It's enjoyed by those who do see it, with some people just not enjoying this type of aspect. I think the slow start to the movie makes it hard for some people to get into. I think sometimes you're hard pressed to get people to engage with their imagination while they're in a film.
Yeah.
And while we talk about like the suspension of disbelief and everything that we get in films, it's hard for people to fully delve into their imagination, which is what this film is all about. So if your audience is having a hard time just engaging with this concept of going into someone's mind who isn't actually projecting his mind, but is pulling on the minds of those who are within the mindscape to create it, it can get a little meta and it can get a little confusing for people. And some people just don't like thinking that much when they're watching a movie.
Yeah, which is kind of what it seems like with this, right? Like, it just seems like it just got too into itself, which it's kind of like Lynchian, right? Like, Terry Gilliam and Lynch kind of have a lot in common with that kind of thing, except Lynch's movies are darker and Gilliam's are a little bit more like bright and bubbly. But yeah, I could see how that's difficult. I don't think whether Heath Ledger lives or dies, I don't think it changes the reception of this movie. I don't think that it changes how much money this movie made. If anything, it should have helped this movie and it didn't, which I think speaks volumes, because this is coming right on the heels of The Dark Knight. He had just won the posthumous Oscar and now this movie comes out with him in it and it just did nothing. And not for nothing. Like, I know Andrew Garfield wasn't what Andrew Garfield is now, but you have Andrew Garfield, you have Christopher Plummer. It's Terry Gilliam, who people know and knew probably better back in 2009 than they do now. And it's Heath Ledger, who I would argue in 2009 was probably the hottest name in Hollywood, even though he was dead. That's how crazy it was, but that's how significant his role as the Joker was. And I mean, I got to Box Office Mojo this and see how much money it actually made, because I know it was not much at all.
Yeah, it's really weird looking at this cast and thinking that this movie wasn't more successful, because it's kind of hard like now to remember that this was one of Andrew Garfield's early movies. This is before The Social Network. So, like, Andrew Garfield hasn't really broken out yet. I think Andrew Garfield's great in this movie. It's just kind of like this whiny, righteous character who's just, you know, going for love and stuff. He's, again, it's a fairy tale, so he very much fits his, like, prototypical role in the movie. Christopher Plummer shows so much range in this movie as, like, this drunk yet wise character. And even, like, the flashback scenes to him as like the monk and everything. And just, he's so good in this movie. But like you said, Tom Waits really steals the show. His performance as Mr. Nick is just so fantastic in every way. he is so smooth and charming. And I mean, a lot of that just has to do with like the raspiness of his voice and how he speaks and everything. But even like the scene where Valentina, where he accidentally claims Valentina's soul, and he's just like fighting so hard so that that's not the case. Like, it shows so much depth to this devil character, where he just has this much honor in this bat and he doesn't want to lose this way.
Yeah. Yeah. Tom Waits is like one of the weirdest stars ever. Like, when Tom Waits is in something, he's always billed super high. Like, I think about, like, with Ballad of Buster Scruggs, and then with Licorice Pizza and everything like that. His music, like, obviously he's the original writer and singer of Jersey Girl, which everybody always associates with Bruce Springsteen. So he does that, but he's got such, like, a distinct persona and a distinct style. And, like, this role really just fits what his distinct persona and distinct style is all about. Like, it just it just nails it. It knocks it out of the park. I really thought that he was just so much fun to watch in this. And Plummer is good, like, kind of, like, butting heads with him. Again, though, like, we know Mr. Nick's motivations the entire time. And I think that is where his character becomes more likable than Plummer's, because we don't really know Plummer's the entire time. We should, but we really don't.
Yeah, and Parnassus's motivation is really best summed up in the monk scene, I think, where they have the monks who are telling the eternal story, and if someone stops telling the story, then all of a sudden the universe will stop existing. And Mr. Nick goes in there and he, you know, takes away all their mouths so no one can tell the story, and then the universe doesn't implode, and he thinks he's making a point, and Parnassus just says it's because someone else somewhere is telling the story. Like, it doesn't have to be here that they're telling it. Someone's telling a story somewhere. And that's the whole point of this movie, is the idea that, like, time is eternal, and these stories will live on forever, and someone's always telling a story, that life's always going on because of it. And it's that inherent hope and belief that Parnassus puts forward that contrasts the cynicism and skepticism of Mr. Nick. But it's so subtly put into the movie that it's kind of hard to realize that that's what's starting this, just, you know, betting relationship between Parnassus and Nick that goes on the entire film.
Yeah, and I love that it's just like bets. They just, like, the devil and the good guy just keep making bet after bet after bet after bet. Like, I love that. And every time they get into the Imaginarium, there's always going to be like that one ridiculous thing that's going to happen, that Mr. Nick's just going to be able to steal the soul and get it easy. It's a really fun concept. It's a really gorgeous movie. I think, like, where it slumps, see, like, when you read, like, what's this movie about, it's like Dr. Parnassus must get 5 souls to save his daughter's life or something like that. For the first hour of the movie, that's not what this movie's about, but it still feels like that's what Dr. Parnassus's motivation is. And that's what threw me off the most. Like, that really just, it just threw me.
Yeah. I mean, because at the beginning of the film, the motivation isn't to save his daughter. The motivation is just to kind of, like, save mankind one soul at a time. Right. The whole point is that, yes, he's up against the devil and stuff and competing for these souls, but he's just trying to help people find enlightenment.
That's a good point. I didn't really think about it like that.
And I think that's the big thing with Parnassus, and what makes him this such an interesting character is the fact that he does have this, like, altruistic opinion on how he's approaching the world and what he's trying to do. But even at the beginning, when we see the first guy go off with Mr. Nick and everything, and he says, "I lost again." Like, this is an eternal struggle for humanity that Parnassus is having with Mr. Nick because of this first bet he made that made him immortal.
And it's like Parnassus wants people to earn it and feel like they're gaining something from it and whatever. Whereas Mr. Nick's like, yeah, just come to this bar and get drunk. I win. Got him. Like, easy enough. Like, it's those simple temptations versus, you know, going through the process to achieve something, not knowing what's actually on the other side, because you're just going to keep going to the simple temptation. It's an interesting little dynamic that they have going on there that, like you said, is eternal and just continues on and on and on the entire time.
Yeah. I this movie, I think it takes like the best of Gilliam and puts it all together here, because you get those moments where it kind of feels like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas with the spectacle and everything. You get like that Monty Python-esque stuff, like the We Love Violence song. Mm-hmm. That I have you ever seen something more Monty Python outside of a Monty Python?
Yeah, exactly.
Work before? It's very clear that Gilliam was a part of that. And just these themes of like this eternal struggle between good and evil, the idea of modernization, the fact that Parnassus can't do anything until Tony comes along and suggests modernizing the show. And the show looks completely different.
Completely different.
And the fact that like it's kind of this good thing because it like lets Parnassus work towards saving these people, but at the same time, it like doesn't feel right. It feels expletive at the same time. It's very interesting. I mean, we have that the idea of like Orientalism with the whole monk scene and everything. It's Gilliam plays a lot on these different themes and pulls them together to create this modern fairy tale that I think more people just need to watch.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's not up there with like a Princess Bride or something like that, in my opinion, but it's a very interesting watch. It's a good movie. How in the world does he ever get, how does he get back to any type of commercial success, or is Terry Gilliam's time over?
Has Terry Gilliam ever really had commercial success though?
I mean, the original Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Yeah. Sure.
But he was one of the six people of Monty Python, right? Like,
that's true.
He was a member of Monty Python. Outside of Monty Python, he hasn't really had commercial success. He has these cult movies that people will swear by.
You think he'll ever get another cult movie, or is he done? I mean, the man who killed Don Quixote, nobody's running around screaming like, woohoo, Terry, way to go.
I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised, but I also wouldn't suspect it at the same time.
Yeah. He's 81 at this point, too. I didn't realize he was so old. Yeah,
that's more why I wouldn't suspect it this time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bummer. I mean, when he's on, I mean, 12 Monkeys, we talked about on this podcast, great movie. Brazil is a very, very entertaining movie. I think the Brothers Grimm is super underrated. I mean, people don't really like the Brothers Grimm, but I quite enjoy the Brothers Grimm. Since Dr. Parnassus, he's really been not able to get anything going in the film world, which is, you know, a shame.
I just think his name doesn't really do anything in the film world is the big thing, right? Like,
I agree.
People like you and I know who Terry Gilliam is, but the layman does not know who he is.
Yeah. And I think like Terry Gilliam has the ability to pull in actors. Like we saw Heath Ledger dies and it's like, hey, I can get Jude Law, Johnny Depp, Colin Farrell. I can get them all. No problem. Done.
Yeah.
Easy. But I do think like, so what? A lot of directors can pull those people. So we don't need it to be a Terry Gilliam movie, especially since it's going to be weird and it's probably not going to make very much money, but it's going to be quite expensive. I mean, $30 million budget for this movie. It made $7 million in America. It made 60 something overall, but it made $7 million in America.
Yeah. I mean, there's also a point where this movie's very British too, which means it's not going to like the masses in America don't tend to like very British movies.
Yeah. Yeah. And Terry Gilliam is certainly that. Do you have anything else you want to say about the Imaginarium, Dr. Parnassus, or you want to move on?
No, I think we covered everything I had to say.
Well, what was the other movie you watched this week?
I did watch Prey this week, mostly because I was looking for a movie to watch to kill time, and I was like, oh, I only have an hour and a half. Turns out I had 3.5 hours, and I was just bad at killing time. So I ended up watching Prey, which, quite frankly, was much better than I expected it to be. Then I saw who directed it, and I was less surprised at how good it was.
Yeah.
Because it is a Dan Trachtenberg film. So the same director as 10 Cloverfield Lane. I'm surprised that the Predator series hadn't tried something like this before. It seems like such a logical decision to do with this series. It felt a lot more in line with the original Predator. And like the casting, having the completely indigenous cast was fantastic. And quite frankly, like it was just really enjoyable.
Yeah, I liked Prey. I didn't love it, but I thought it was good. It was way, like you said, it's way better than I thought it was going to be, which is huge because, you know, you're coming into this. I mean, when was the last good Predator movie that involved anything with Predator? And I'm going to be honest, I didn't even realize it was a Predator movie when I sat down to watch it. My dad just said, do you want to watch this? Because he was down here. And I was like, sure, let's throw it on. And I actually quite liked it. I thought it was good.
Yeah, it surprised me, but it's worth a watch. If you enjoy those type of movies, give it a watch. It was fun.
Yeah. I got two that I gave 4 stars this week, and I really don't know which one I actually liked more. I watched Z last night, and I watched Anatomy of a Murder on Sunday night. Z is a very interesting movie. It's like all about like anti-government and the opposition and just like, you know, fascism and all that. Freaking good movie, and it doesn't really give you a place to focus at all. Like, kind of has like a guerrilla style to it. It was 1969, so it's kind of like really gritty. That was a great one. And then Anatomy of a Murder is a Jimmy Stewart, George C. Scott, like courtroom drama. That was so much better than it has any business being. Otto Preminger, it's always considered one of the great courtroom dramas of all time. But I was like, okay, how good can it really be? It is. It doesn't tell you who to root for the whole time. It really shows the flaws of everybody for the most part. And even when they finally make their verdict at the end of the movie, you're like, I don't know. Like, I don't know how I feel about it. And that's impressive for a movie from the 1950s. It's like 2 hours and 40 minutes long, but it doesn't feel that long. I really enjoyed that movie. Really thought it was a good one. And I'd probably say I liked Z more, but that's also because I watched Z last night. So it's probably just fresh in my brain. But Z is a foreign language film or international film, as we now have to call it at the Oscars. And so is The Secret in Their Eyes, 2009. Ricardo Darín is the main character in this movie. I'm a huge Ricardo Darín fan. I have him coming up again at another point when we talk about Wild Tales. He's in that. Juan José Campanella is the director of this movie. I don't know how Juan José Campanella made this movie, because go look at the rest of his filmography. You've never heard of it. It doesn't exist. It's whatever. But when it comes to this movie, the reason why this one stands out to me, at the end of the day, is a pretty straightforward mystery film. Mm-hmm. Who murdered and raped this woman? That's pretty much that's what it is. And it's a detective now in old age looking back on his time and how that case went wrong. We've seen this movie done to death. But Campanella is able to create so much heart and so much drama from every character. He's able to keep pulling the wool over your eyes a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, to the point where 35, 40 minutes into this movie, you know who killed her. You know who raped and you know who murdered her. And yet for the next hour and 30 minutes, you're like, how the hell is this going to end? Like, what is going on? What is going on? What is going on? And there's something to be said about understanding the genre you're creating a film in, right? Like, we just talked about Imaginary Dr. Parnassus. Terry Gilliam knows how to make these fantasy, over the top, whatever genre you want to call that. But this movie, understanding the film noir and understanding the mystery genre, is what leads to this movie just being at the top of my list. Very rarely do we see so much emotion from the protagonists in these movies. His love story with the woman, his care for, you know, these other people, his partner, all that stuff, and how it's just like his whole life has just kind of unraveled since all of this has been over. But the ending scene, so if you haven't watched it, just turn this off now. The ending scene when he goes to the house and the guy tells him, yeah, I killed him, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, okay, I've seen this movie before. Good job, Secret in Their Eyes. Like, that was a really well-constructed movie, phenomenal, whatever. And he's driving home and he's just saying, what is 4 bullets going to get me? It's not going to bring her back. It's not going to do this. It's not going to do that. And he goes back and drives in. And when he goes into that place, and you realize, oh shit, when he was carrying that tray wasn't for him. And he goes back there and it's a guy who just comes walking out. It's the rapist and murderer in old age. And all he says is, can you just have him talk to me? The windows are blocked out. It's the one fake light. He's giving him the food all the time. He's barred in there and there's nothing he can do. He's just keeping him alive. A life of nothing. It is one of the most devastating, brutal endings ever. And what does it do? It goes from that to him finally going in and talking to her, and she, and they actually close the door. And it's like one of my favorite last shots, because the whole movie, close the door. Oh, no, no, no. He's got to come in. Close the door. Oh, no, no, no. He's got to come in. Just close the door. And now they can finally just be what they need to be. It is so good. That ending scene, though, oh, my God. That reveal that that's where he's been the whole time. One of the best reveals ever. And I can't get enough of it.
Yeah, I think Campanella just really strings you along this entire movie. Like you said, we find out who the murderer is, like, incredibly early in this film. And I was really confused, because I read, like, the IMDb tagline for this movie before watching it, and it's just like, yeah, this court official is reminiscing on this case that he didn't solve from 25 years ago. I'm like, but they know who did it. Yeah, and then they catch him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but now he's caught. What? And then you get to the point where he's released despite confessing it. And you're like, okay. And the way that, you know, you have Pablo Sandoval in there the entire time as this character, you're like, well, why isn't Sandoval around later? I mean, yeah, okay, I guess it could be old age. And then you get to him being murdered, and you're like, oh my God, what's happening? And even that last scene where he's talking with him, and he drives off, and you're like, wait, he didn't kill his own wife, did he?
Mm-hmm.
And then you get back, and you're like, no, because he knew murder wasn't good enough for this guy.
Yeah.
He knew killing this guy was not what should be done. It's just, it's devastating. It's so gorgeous. The way it's shot, absolutely beautiful. I'm so glad this movie was on your list, because I don't think it's one that I would have gotten around to otherwise for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
But absolutely phenomenal for this, like, straight up, like you said, this really straightforward movie.
Yeah, there's nothing unique really about this story at all. I mean, it's a very run-of-the-mill, you know, we didn't solve that case. Oh, now you want to talk about it when we're in old age, and let's go back and let's look at it. And it's obviously a grisly murder and one that would haunt people, but we see that all the time in these types of movies. Like, that's what it's what this genre is most of the time. It's just people doing that and talking about that and whatever. And I just, like, I love what it's able to accomplish without having to go so over the top. Like, think about a movie like Seven, right? Which we both had on our lists. You have a movie like Seven that is, has to be so overly stylized to get its point across. Or Zodiac, which you have coming up on your list. Like, that's one that's based on some infamous murder that we all know so much about. This is just a made up story. And like you said, okay, he gets caught right away and he confesses and then they let him go. Okay, but that doesn't mean it's an unresolved murder case. But how do you continue to get 2 hours and 10 minutes out of that? Character, 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 character. And every one of these characters in this movie is great. I love the scene where Pablo Sandoval is in the is sitting down, and it's the passion. It's the passion. It's why you can't, whenever she walks in the room, you can't think of what to say, you can't think of what to do, and you're always just thinking about her because that's your passion. It's why I want to come to this bar every day and get drunk, because it's my passion. What's his passion? And he starts, he goes to the guy, starts rattling off all the freaking things. And they go to that, stadium. It's so well done and well told. And then you're like, okay, this is the first time they're at the stadium. He's like, we've been doing this for over a month. Oh, it's never going to work. It's never going to work. And they just turn and they go, there he is.
Yeah.
That stadium scene, one of the best film things ever filmed in film. That is one shot from the time it zooms in. Now, obviously, I know there's a cut there, but it zooms all the way in, gets to the stadium, and then it's just one shot continuous for the remainder of that time as they run through, as he escapes, he jumps off the ledge, they're chasing him down. It's so unbelievably well done with, and it creates such an adrenaline rush. And again, a movie that's not trying to be that. It's not trying to be some crazy action movie, but when it picks its moments, it picks its moments, and it knows how to really capitalize on those.
Yeah, I mean, the really interesting thing I found about this film is this is just a love story.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the entire, like, the main concept of this movie is just love, because it's about the fact that Esposito like has this love for Irene that like they haven't been able to ever talk about over 25 years. And obviously the fact that the husband, what was his name? Morales or something like that?
Yeah, he's Morales, I think.
Morales?
Yeah.
I think that Morales has his love for Liliana and everything like that, and that's driving him. And so all these like, this love is so integral to this story, but you kind of forget it by the way it's framed, where it's framed as like this, this flashback to what's happening in this case as he's writing the story. Mm-hmm. And because he's writing the story, you're also left questioning like how much of this is reliable. It's playing with that reliability trope, right? And that is established immediately at the beginning by those two very ethereal scenes we get,
mm-hmm.
where we have the train scene, which we see again later,
mm-hmm.
Played out in reality, but it's very ethereal, it's very light, it's very bright. And then we have Morales at breakfast that morning, and then it's intercut with this brutal rape and murder.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's playing with contrast, it's playing with expectation. It's such a strong way of getting points across and making you feel something while you're watching this movie.
Yeah, I agree. This movie is all about, it's a love story that's all about storytelling too. Mm-hmm. And like the stories that you have to tell to get yourself by. I mean, I think it's interesting. Like all of those openings are, this is, you know, I don't know how to start my book. I don't know how to start it. And he's going to start it with the really romantic way because that's what matters to him. And he's going to start it with the really graphic, grisly way because that's what's going to sell. And then she says to him, just start with when it first started to matter. And then that's when we really start to get into the story, because what is it that actually matters? And I love that idea, because then it comes up again later in the movie. What was the last thing Pablo Sandoval did? I don't know, but I just know that in my house, all the pictures were face down. And mm-hmm. I like to think that he made them think that he was me. But you know what? Somebody just might have bumped into him and knocked him over. Like, I love that kind of thing, like that kind of story, the story that Morales does tell about going and killing the guy, even though he has established numerous times that that's not what's going to happen. But that story, the stories about that's being created by the crooked cop who's trying to frame people for the murder and blah, blah, blah. There's so many things going on in this movie that are, you know, like you're saying, the unreliable, reliable, whatever. That just makes it feel so real.
Mm-hmm.
And that realness, I think, is like what really sets this movie apart from others of the genre. And it's so funny that the American version, I never seen it, but it's supposedly just like pure trash.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it just kind of misses what makes this movie special. Because what makes this movie special is that it can go from one extreme to the other of, oh my God, how beautiful is this moment, to here's the grisliest, most brutal rape scene you're ever going to see.
Yeah, and a lot of that does come down to the performances in this movie, too. The even the smallest facial expressions that we're seeing throughout the film, they tell you everything. Before we're even told that Esposito loves Irene, you see it on his face. You can see it the moment he sees her, the moment he walks into that room, that he's in love with this woman. And like, those are the little things that make movies excel.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the little things that push a movie over the top. When you have actors who can just act so naturally, it's especially, like you said, going from these massive extremes.
I have two Ricardo Darín movies in my top 100, and I've never seen another Ricardo Darín movie. Like, those are the only two I've seen, but I have them both in my top 100. He's just – there's something just so average about him that really works. Mm-hmm. I almost feel like he's kind of like a better-looking Philip Seymour Hoffman, where, like, the reason why people, I think, connected so much with Philip Seymour Hoffman was because you could relate so much to him. I could be Philip Seymour Hoffman. I can't be Brad Pitt. Like, those are the differences. Yeah. And I feel like Ricardo Darín is kind of that guy where, like, he can – you buy that he would be, like, a legal counselor or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, you buy that that would be his role. In Wild Tales, you'll see what he plays. I don't want to spoil it because it's just – it's the best part of the movie. But, like, there's so many things with, like, with his face and everything. You just buy that he wouldn't be suave enough to get this girl, but that he is smart ass enough to get the friends and to get through this job in this pretty corrupt kind of system. You buy all of that stuff with him. And the same thing with what's her name? Soledad Villamil. Like, she's not in anything else. Like, I've never seen her before, but she's so, there's so much chemistry between those two actors in this movie. And when you're having, when this movie is about a unsolved rape murder case, and yet you can have that beautiful of a love story in it, that's when you're starting to, you know, you're moving up, you're moving on up.
Yeah. Contrasting those two themes to make it, I mean, I talked about it a few weeks ago where I went and saw Where the Crawdads Sings. This is what I expected that movie to be. Mm-hmm. I obviously was very wrong about that movie, but
I didn't see it
this,
either, yeah.
This just filled that hole that I was looking for, that this like mystery that also can have that like love story in with it. It, you also kind of just forget about the love story through it too, which is nice because it's just interplaced just enough that it remains constant, but you get so engulfed in this case of trying to figure out this, not who the murderer is, but where the murderer is, that it just keeps it going. And the interrogation scene where Irene comes in because they can't find Sandoval. So she comes in and she just immediately realizes that this guy's lusting over her.
Yeah.
And that she can use that to get a confession out of him. It's phenomenal. And it's one of those things where it seems like it's undermining, but you just know because of the subtle shots in the camera, the subtle angles that are being used, that this is all planned and they know exactly what they're doing. And then, you know, he whips it out and you're like, yeah, you're done now.
Yep. That's all it took. She got what she wanted. No, but it's so true. And like, it shows her character in such a different light too, of like when she can just take over and do all of that. But again, like, this movie is Esposito's movie. Like, he is the protagonist of this movie, but every other character is so well-defined and every other character's motivations are so well. Her trying to be taken seriously. And when she needs to, she can turn it on and she can hang with anybody. She's gonna get what she needs to get out of this situation. Like, that's the kind of stuff that's just phenomenal. And I think like the characters, the story, the score, which is beautiful. I love the Her Eyes theme, which plays throughout. It's at the beginning, it plays again later, like it plays all the time. I think that's just a beautiful score. But all of that stuff that's going on, it doesn't need to amount to a lot. Ultimately, this could just be a couple good scenes and a couple good moments, but it takes its time with everybody. So that in the biggest moment of the movie up to that point, when they are finally getting this murderer, it's her moment, not Ricardo Darin's. It's her moment. That doesn't work in most movies. That feels very unsatisfying in most movies. And if you think about it, Ricardo Darin's big moment is catching the guy. Yeah. Other than that, after that, that's 40 minutes into the movie, whatever it is. After that, he doesn't have a big moment again. He's just kind of moseying around, moping and trying to figure out, oh, now this happened, this happened, blah, blah. He doesn't have another big moment. But it's still his story because he's the one who's ultimately going to tell this story. That's a really hard thing to pull off. Not give these big moments to your protagonist.
Yeah, but it helps that the way the film's framed is our protagonist is also our narrator. Because that lets you get away from it, right? It's kind of like, it's like a Shawshank, right?
Yeah.
Where we have Morgan Freeman being the narrator that entire movie, but he's not the protagonist of the film, right? It's a trope that when used correctly, it can be done so well. Because it allows you to have just this leniency in how you treat the characters in the film.
Yeah. No, that's true. Because, with Shawshank, the reason that movie works is because it's not from Tim Robbins' point of view. If it was from Andy Dufresne's point of view, it doesn't have the same feel because you need to have it from kind of the insider. And realistically, Red and Esposito are both insiders. It's not the bad thing or the important thing doesn't happen to them, but they're the ones who have the knowledge of the situation. Yeah. Probably the most knowledge of it because they know everything else that's going on around it. They might not necessarily know what's going on in that moment, but they know everything that's going on around it. I think that is like the telling thing. And, you know, you think about, we just watched Goodfellas last week or 2 weeks ago, whatever it was now. And Goodfellas is one of those movies where the narrator is the protagonist, and that's fine, but that's a totally different style of movie. And think about how different that movie, like even in that one, it's him learning the mob. If you wanted to go a different route, you could have made that the point of view of Robert De Niro talking about this kid coming up in the mob, and it'd still work. And that's kind of like, that's the approach that this movie takes, where Ricardo Darín is the protagonist, but he's like a bystander for so much of it. But that's what makes it feel realistic. I mean, we're all the protagonists of our own lives, right? Like, we're all the ones who feel like we're in control and making the decisions and doing whatever. Yet in reality, we're just peripheral to everybody else. And most of the things that happen to us are happening because of other people. That's what this movie does. A lot of movies won't do that. It, you know, here's your Superman, or here's your detective, or here's your this, or here's your that. I mean, think about Chinatown, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks. Chinatown's a movie where everything is Getty's. Everything is Getty's. It's what's going on through his eyes. How is it affecting him? This movie's not that. It's just, man, I really wish we would have figured out this murder, and I want to know what happened so I can write a story about it, because I think people need to know.
Yeah, it just lets you, it makes the story feel more objective rather than subjective, which is hard to pull off, because when you're making something objective, it's hard to make it so it's not boring. But because we do get enough of Esposito's viewpoint throughout the movie still, it feels like we can just engage with these characters so well. And even like structurally, the film does such a good job at foreshadowing literally everything that happens in the movie. Obviously, like, the letters drop the soccer player names, and like, if you were big enough into Argentinian soccer during the 50s and 60s, you would have picked up on that, I guess.
Also, the A isn't working.
The A isn't working, exactly. Yep. Which,
and he writes Tamo.
Yeah, like, that's brilliant. Such a huge moment. It's so huge. Like, this idea of like taking fear into love, like, I don't think there's a better way of like encapsulating this film than simply writing an A on that piece of paper. It was just a beautiful end to the film. And even things like Sandoval getting drunk and then his wife saying he can't come home. Like, it completely sets up the fact that later in the film, Sandoval's going to get drunk, have to stay at Esposito's place, and then die there. There are so many little things that happen early on in this movie that just pay off so well later on.
Yeah. And that's it. Like, it's the little stuff in this. It's all the minor details. I mean, when they're talking about the A still won't freaking work. Like, how are they typing on something where the A doesn't work? He's got to write his story. He's got to keep writing in the A's, writing in the A's, writing in the A's. He has a dream. He writes Tamo, which also like works out so well in the Spanish language. Tamo means I fear, te amo means I love, or whatever it is. It's like, wow. Yeah. Okay. Like, that's just very convenient. But also like it's brilliant writing. I mean, it's brilliant writing. And those are the things that are missing from a lot of movies of this genre. Like, they get so caught up in the murder mystery. They get so caught up in the love story. They don't sleep together in this movie. They never even get close to sleeping together. The train moment shouldn't even have an impact, but it does, because at that point, we've already seen her try to get him to go beyond where he's gone. And he won't do it because he's too stupid. So now that train moment means something. And the reason that train moment means something at the end is because we see him try to start off the whole story with it, because that's how important it was to him at the beginning. That's the good stuff. Like, that's the really good stuff.
Yeah, it just shows an understanding of story structure that most films can't replicate.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to see what ultimately ends up happening with, you know, the rest of movies that Ricardo Darín can like put himself in. I'm excited to see what comes out of Latin America, mm-hmm. because this Wild Tales, those are movies that like they shouldn't have been as popular as they were. And then they became very popular and whatever. And people like heard about them and all that stuff. Why can't we see more of these every year? Like, why are we not getting one of these churned? Like, when Latin America makes a great movie, they make a great movie.
Yep.
How do we get more of that coming? And like, that's, I'm excited to see in like the future, what genre is going to be like the next one that like all of a sudden you're just like, whoa, where did that come from? And like the international game that the American game just can't make, like the movie, like The Hunt or like The Secret in Their Eyes or Wild Tales, which you haven't seen yet, but we'll get to. Like, how, like, what's going to be that next one that's going to have that type of impact? Like, how can, and why was this movie able to dissect this genre and make such a good movie that then America just couldn't make at all? Like, why is it that the international was able to figure it out? But I don't know. I'm just, I look forward to what's going to be the next Secret in Their Eyes in like 5 years that really blows our mind, because there hasn't been, I would say, you know, Another Round was a good movie and like, you know, that was a lot of fun and everything, but there hasn't been like a movie like this that is taking one of the most basic genres of Hollywood and doing it better than Hollywood does.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things. It's one of the beauties of exploring international cinema. Is seeing these different perspectives on tried and true genres that we see all the time. And Latin America is just one of those markets that doesn't get enough exposure ever. We're just getting to the point now because of, you know, growing interest in anime and growing interest in things like Parasite. We're just getting to a point now where Asian cinema is becoming more easily accessible in North America. So I really hope we get to the point where Latin America is also on that level, where we're also getting plenty of movies from Latin America so we can see these different perspectives. I would love to see films. And the question is like, when does an African film like this come out?
Yeah,
right? 'Cause we don't talk about African films like that, but they have to be out there. It's just one of those things that exploring international cinema gives you an opportunity to find a film like The Secret in Their Eyes.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the reason I watched this back in 2009, 2010, whatever it was, because it was on Netflix and, you know, whatever it was nominated for best foreign film. And it was like, all right, let's just watch it. And I remember we sat down, it was me, my dad, and my one friend, and we just watched and we're like, holy crap, that was a great movie. And it's an Argentinian movie. There's not many Argentinian movies that ever get over here to America by any means, but you have The Secret in Their Eyes, and then 5 years later, Wild Tales comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wow. But name another Argentinian movie that's come out since then. I don't know if you could. Sure. Yeah, I don't know if you could. I couldn't. But it's kind of like, okay, if this is like the 60s with French, right? Like, or like whatever. It's like, okay, here it all is. Here it is. Here it is. Or Italian cinema, whatever it is. I think the hardest part is that when you're in Latin America, when you're in South America, all that, it's just so hard to produce movies and get movies made because of, you know, budgeting reasons and everything like that. It's the same reason why I've seen two Ricardo Darín movies. They're both in my top 100, but I've seen two. And to me, I'd be shocked if you didn't know who the hell Ricardo Darín was. And then I look at it and I'm like, why would anybody know who the hell Ricardo Darín is? Like, I know who he is. Nobody else should know who he is. That's the kind of stuff that's like interesting to me. Like, it's none of these people really made any impact in American cinema. And yet this movie won the Oscar for best international film. And like you just said, look at Parasite, look at what Another Round did. Like, those are movies that were all the talk, all the rage when they came out. It wasn't happening 12 years ago, 13 years ago, which is a shame because in my opinion, Secret in Their Eyes is better than both of them.
Yeah.
Anyway, John, we don't have to keep talking. We can go home.
Okay.
We're good.
What's next week?
What's next week? Let's talk about next week. So next week we are going full America and we're going Beauty and the Beast for John, Whiplash for myself. That's the Beauty and the Beast from 1991. Don't worry. It's not the live action, and Whiplash from 2014. I don't know what other Whiplash it would be, but that's the one. That's our number 28. And How many duplicates do we actually have left at this point? We only have two more duplicates. Two? So we do an Interstellar and Midnight in Paris at later dates, but those are two movies that we still have coming up that are, you know, of course, not actually in our top 100, but number 28. I'm excited about that one. Whiplash and Beauty and the Beast, two of my favorites. I really like Beauty and the Beast. That was close to making my list, and maybe one day I'll become man enough to put it on there. But until then, I'll just let John have it at number 28, and I'll just talk about it that way. But thank you all for listening. Join Discord. We have our conversations in there. I'm sure Discord's going to pick up in about a month when Survivor starts, and we'll really get rolling with all that. So thank you all for listening to this podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. If you haven't seen The Secret in Their Eyes and for some reason you listen to this, still go watch it, even though now you know everything great about the movie. We'll see you next time.